Monster Man, Episode 278, Creature Collection. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our look at other monster books, and I was going to say contemporary ones, but this book is in fact 20 years old, so that was an uncomfortable realization. We're between seasons 3 and 4 of Monster Man, and we're looking at all sorts of miscellaneous monster books, and today we're going to look at the Creature Collection. I feel like this is one that I might return to in more detail later on, and not just because I did buy it, but I think that there are quite a lot of interesting monsters in it, and kind of some interesting tips for the way that monsters are designed. To begin with, let's talk about a little bit of historical background. This book was published by White Wolf, so it was published for Sword and Sorcery Studios by White Wolf in 2000, and this was at the time when Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition was being released. Now, the release of Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition was a very significant one in the game's history. It was the first edition from new publisher Wizards of the Coast, and it revivified interest in Dungeons & Dragons, a game which, you know, AD&D at that time was in kind of the doldrums. And 3rd edition, without really changing much of the content of the game, although obviously it changed the rules, revived interest in it in a way that, you know, maybe just it needs a big news story to do. 3rd edition was also the edition that introduced the famous open game license, which is the foundation stone of the OSR. This was a strategy by WotC where the goal was to get other publishers to publish the wide range of different products that would help support demand from players of the game while not forcing WotC to maintain this huge catalog of things like modules, which didn't sell very well compared to core books. So the wide variety of different books that were available for 3rd was meant to make it kind of a cornerstone of the gaming market, and in a way, that strategy succeeded. But I really like the story of the Creature Collection. You see, like 1st edition, 3rd edition's core rulebooks were not all released at the same time. Now, they weren't separated by a year, as they were in the case of 1st edition, but they were separated by, like, a month. So the Player's Handbook came out, and then the other two. I don't remember the order. But the information about 3rd edition had been available to other game publishers for a while, the idea being that this would help support them in making adventures and things so that there would be a wash of D&D content coming out to supply people who were excited about the new game. So you could buy the rulebook and then have a bunch of scenarios that you could pick up that day in the same shop. Good strategy. What Sword and Sorcery Studios and White Wolf did was come up with a monster book, a nice hardback, you know, it's got an alliterative name, etc. And in 2000, it was priced at $24.95 in US dollars, which is pretty reasonable for a big hardback gaming book in those days. The D&D Player's Handbook was initially only $20, so, and then it went up to $30 later on, if I recall correctly. So this was a big, appealing-looking monster book at a reasonable price point, and crucially, it came out before the official Monster Manual, right? This came out the same time as the Player's Handbook, or more or less anyway. And so for many people, this was actually their first 3rd edition monster book, which means that for many people, it may have been their first D&D monster book. Because it was published by a big publisher, a lot of stores carried it. And because the content of the Monster Manual was very predictable, right? It's going to have orcs and gnolls and bugbears and goblins and dragons and, you know, demons and devils and golems, and it's going to have skeletons and zombies and vampires and wraiths and hags and, you know, like, content was pretty easy to anticipate. So the Scarlands Creature Collection has a bunch of weird stuff in it. Production's not quite as nice as the WotC books. It's black and white interior rather than the full color interior that the WotC books had, but it still, it looks pretty good. It's got some good artists in there, in particular, there's art by Guy Davis, who you may be more likely to know from his comics work on titles like BPRD. And the standard is generally pretty high. It's clearly organized. Each monster has a single page spread with a stat block, a large clear illustration, and then a, you know, couple columns explaining what their deal is. So that's the background. Let's talk about the book itself. Now, I've picked two monsters, again, at random. I just kind of flipped through the book and I picked out two, and I think they're interesting. I'm not completely wild about either of them, but I think that there's interesting things to say. First up, we've got Garabrood, the Obsidian Hound. Garabrood, the Obsidian Hound, is a monster of a type that is pretty familiar to us by now. It is a black dog, effectively a hellhound of the hellhound on my trail variety, that tracks people down and kills them. And by kills them, I mean it kills them. This thing's got AC 28, over 200 hit points, a plus 33 bite attack that does 3d12 plus 12 damage. It is a brute. It's a CR 14, if that means anything to you. And it reminded me that there were some ridiculous aspects to 3rd edition. And there's an extensive background, well, extensive, there's, you know, a couple columns of background explaining what Garabrood is, where it comes from, and how it behaves. And what's interesting is that how it behaves is not interesting at all, or is mostly not interesting. Garabrood selects a target. Well, it doesn't select a target. A target is selected for Garabrood. No one knows how. Garabrood, wherever it is, begins to track unerringly that person, tracks them down, kills them, and then gets a new target. The only interesting detail here is that the person being targeted by Garabrood begins to have nightmares, which is pretty cool. And you can see how those could become like a prophetic way to figure out the solution to being targeted by Garabrood, except that there isn't one. You're just probably gonna die. So what we get is a couple of columns of detailed background explaining that Garabrood can't be reasoned with, never misses, and you're just going to have to fight it. So it's a whole lot of context for a big fight, all of which is kind of irrelevant to the fight. Right? Your response, knowing all the detail about Garabrood and not knowing all the detail about Garabrood, is going to be the same. It's going to turn up, and you're going to cast Fireball at it. Also, I don't think we're ever going to need to know that Garabrood has plus 8 wilderness lore, but that is a failing of 3rd edition, not of this monster. Now, initially, I was just like, yeah, this is annoying, and this is a common feature of NPC write-ups, where the character's background is less a way of giving them motivation and making them fun for the PCs to interact with than it is of covering the author's backside in terms of, like, walling off other possible approaches. As someone once described this as, every NPC has 1,000 words of background that explains why they attack on sight, fight to the death, and never negotiate. Because it's still the same old nonsense, but now it's psychologically plausible? Actually, I think there's more going on here. Because like a lot of monster books, the Creature Collection is also a stealth setting book. Each of these monster entries is full of information about the Scarred Land setting, and I think that that was the idea, to use these to, you know, build up a picture of the Scarred Lands setting so that people would then buy the other Scarred Lands books and play in the setting and so forth. I don't know how successful that was, but they came out with more than one of these books, and I know there were other Scarred Lands books, both setting and scenario, so presumably people responded to it to some extent. And that hasn't been that true of the D&D books, because at the point where we are in the early 80s, there isn't a single unified Dungeons & Dragons setting. We have seen a few references to, you know, this monster behaves this way because of this aspect of the politics of the world of Greyhawk. And we've seen a lot of stuff about the other planes. But in terms of what's going on the Prime Material plane, Gygax and co. apparently don't feel they can include setting detail because there isn't a single agreed-upon setting. Next up, we got the Gnarleth. Now, the Gnarleth is kind of like a reverse Drider, by which I mean it has humanoid legs and a humanish upper body, but then it's got 4 arms, not 6, which I thought was odd, and a spider head. So it's a spidery monster. We get a little bit of background, but not very much, about how in olden days they were a plague upon the elves, and they were created, no one knows how, but we'll say that at some length. And they've got everything you want a spider monster. They got a venomous bite, they spit webs, which is not what spiders do, but it seems to be the consensus. You know, it's got webby powers, which a lot of spider monsters have powers more reminiscent of Spider-Man than actual spiders. I'm sure I've said that before. The Gnarleth is fine. It's quite tough. It does permanent constitution damage if you get bit with its venom. It's very evil. It's got a description of how, because they were once almost hunted to extinction by the elves, now they're basically just kind of nursing their vengeancy grudge or whatever. And yeah, it's got a creepy image. I don't think the idea of something with a spider head is very appealing, right? Spiders are very scary looking. Or funny looking. There's a thin line between the two. There is kind of an interesting disconnect between the illustration and the description here, because the description says that the Gnarleth has like claw-tipped hands, whereas the illustration shows it with 4 curved swords. It also has kind of a loincloth and pirate boots, which gives it a sort of a Conan-y appearance, and a big buff muscular chest as opposed to the gaunt bony frame described in the writing. So again, I wonder if that's a product of a book being put together, you know, in a hurry to meet a very, very specific deadline. But the Gnarleth is more akin, I think, to the general tenor of this book than Garibrood the Obsidian Hound. Garibrood the Obsidian Hound is, for all its, like, souped-upness, is clearly a souped-up version of a well-known folkloric monster. The Nurgleth is a pretty obvious combination. I mean, it's an animal plus a person, which is not too outre. But there are a lot of weird monsters in this book, and a lot of monsters that take as their premise that D&D exists. So, for example, there are these four monsters which are basically, like, cursed evil versions of standard player character tropes. So there's, like, a paladin that, or a fighter, and he's got the faithless knight, and then there's the evil priest, and the, you know, so on and so forth, right? You know, so there's an evil rogue, an evil cleric, an evil bard, and an evil paladin. Or there are a lot of weird dragons, you know, again, going on the assumption that the ordinary dragons would already be covered. So there's no goblin equivalent, you know, there's no, like, regular meat and potatoes monsters. There's only weird ones. And some of them are quite weird. So, for example, one of them is a virus that you can get, the Slaresian language virus, which muddles up your brain's speech centers. So that's quite interesting, I think. Now, I'm not going to do this book start to finish, but I do think that there are some good ones in here that I might come back and take a look at a later time, even though we're not out here playing third edition. And if you are, I salute you, I guess. But there are a few that I think are interesting monsters in their own right, and there are a lot that I think are interesting looks at the developing play culture of the game, and kind of in this time when a new play culture is being formed, different people are kind of making their bids to influence it in different ways. So once again, I have to tell you that next week we're going to be covering topics that I have no idea what they are, because I'm making this all up as I go along. I do have some more monster books downloaded, and I'm going to maybe take a look at a few of those. We'll see. I don't know until I do it. It's all being done kind of on the spur of the moment, and I have to tell you that that's very relaxing. I'm really enjoying this little break, and looking forward, however, to getting into Season 4 of Monster Man. A show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.